Egal Hamelin, so good to see you at Radio.
Likewise, Thomas.
Egal, in this summer you will become a rabbi. You are a drama therapist, and we are very long time spiritual friends. So it's a very
Yes.
special occasion to be able to talk to you.
Likewise. Yes. Thank you for having me.
You had quite a spiritual life, if I may say so. That started in a Jewish context, that led you to all different kind of fields of spirituality and brought you to Jewish mysticism. So that's interesting. It's very, in itself is a life story, very interesting. And I really would love to hear parts of the life story and part of what brought you back to Jewish mysticism. And understand deeper what Jewish mysticism is in the first place. So wherever you would like to start, I really would like to understand your relationship to mysticism, Jewish mysticism, and how should we think about it? How should we see it?
Well, thanks for the question. Yeah, if I answered everything that you asked, we'll be here for a few hours. But I will say that, where does the call to spiritual search come from? I have no idea. But I know I was in medical school. I was 18 years old. And 3 months into medical school, I realized, nope, this is not for me. I have to become conscious. I'm not conscious. I just live like an automaton going around. And in fact, I'd like to correct you. It didn't start, my search did not start in the Jewish context. In fact, what happened was when it dawned on me, this is not my place. I thought I should finish the first year of medical school and then go to do the army service and then go to India and find a guru. That was the, I did, I don't know where it came. At that time, it wasn't that popular. We're talking 52 years ago. And one thing led to the other, and the first 25 years of my search were in the context of relationship with Maharshi Mahesh Yogi, who was a Hindu. I would say, though, that I always say that a Hindu guru made me a Jew. Because until that time, I grew up, of course, I knew I was Jewish, I grew up in Israel. Judaism didn't have any, it wasn't my defining character. I was interested in science and philosophy, but not in religion. But the moment I started meditating, the depth of that first experience made me realize, oh, all this biblical stuff that we learned at school, they didn't get it. There's something else here. And it just dawned on me there and then that I should look into my own tradition and I will find from this perspective of a mystical experience, I will find greater depth. And that's exactly what happened. So from the beginning of my time with Maharshi, he recognized how much I'm interested in my own tradition. And then he encouraged me also to look into the mystical teaching of other traditions. So from the very beginning, it was really in the context of mystical teachings of the different religions.
So in our conversation, I think we could go many lengths to just to go along your life story
Yes.
of Indian mysticism, the different routes that you followed there, and you're coming back. I would like to make a shortcut
Sure.
and ask you directly, in the end, what brought you? I may say back, you said it is
Yeah.
not back in the sense that you started as a conscious person, but as an identity, as a culture background. you somehow were connected to that, at least there's something to kind of separate from.
Yeah.
And in the end, you don't separate from, you embrace it. And what made you embrace it?
Yeah. So, first of all, I'd like to say something that's kind of obvious. God is not Jewish. God is not Christian. God is not Muslim. And in fact, God is not God. It's like the Tao Te Ching says, the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. So the mystical experience does not belong to any culture. But sometime, I was interested in the mystical experience as it was portrayed in the different religions, always somehow, however, knowing that I am Jewish and that this is a fundamental. And what does it mean, I am Jewish? It means that I come from, for me, that's what it means. I come from a line of people who, for hundreds and thousands of years, had a particular connection to the absolute. It's a particular connection to that transcendental field of life. Is that, quote unquote, better than others? Mm-hmm. No. But it's the milieu in which I arose from childhood, even though I didn't grow up religious, the expressions of that language were used to distinguish in between the nuances of the heavenly realm. And so this is kind of, it's the path that would be most natural for me. And so I was always interested in it. And somehow around 10 or more years ago, I thought to myself, you know what? It's time to stop making it a serious hobby and start having Judaism as the organizing principles around which my spiritual life revolves. That was a very natural wholesome kind of experience of, yes, that's the next direction to go. And I just followed it.
So you have a very direct and very deep relationship, at least to two forms of spirituality, with your many years with India, partially in India, and at least since 10 years coming back to this Jewish calling. You made the point how the relationship to the mystery is not related to any ethnic background or cultural background. But there is something different in all the variation. I'm hesitant to talk about Indian spirituality because there are so many versions of Indian spirituality. But on one hand that, and on the other hand, Judaism in its different forms. What is the specific? What is the calling for Jewish mysticism? There's one dimension that I understand, or maybe I just seemingly understand. That is that Jewish mysticism is very much also connected to a Jewish culture. People who identify, as you said, to a line of humans who lived a specific way of life in relationship to the absolute through many millennia, which is in itself is kind of startling fact, because I don't know if there is any other example like that, at least not many. So I can see that. But of course, I look at Jewish mysticism not as a Jew. And when you talk, when you think of, when you contemplate, when you're spiritually interested in forms of mysticism, when you talk about Christian mysticism, Buddhism, Shivaism, all that, when you feel drawn, there's always this thought or this possibility to go there. For a non-ethnic Jew, this is different in Jewish mysticism. It's very much, this is something very interesting, but it's not for me, because it's made not for me. It's made for this line of people who have this cultural background, who created this beautiful tradition that we all learn from. I mean, talk about Christianity and Islam. We also learn from, but it itself, it's not for me. Is that a correct perception?
So it depends who you ask. But it is true for historical cultural reasons that for most of its history, Judaism, and still today, it's not a missionary religion. It never sought converts. And even if you look at Jesus' instructions to his disciples, he told them to stay away from non-Jewish villages and just basically concern themselves with Jews. We have to understand that Judaism arose at a very different time and through the generations, and they had to protect themselves. There was a cultural, historical situation where Jews were discriminated against, and when you're continuously discriminated against, you have, of course, one of your defenses. No, I'm better than anybody else. They just don't realize it. So that was part of it. And part of it, there was an understanding of, listen, there was an ethnic understanding of Judaism for a long time. But Judaism has always given a path to people who wanted to join if they found a very deep calling. Only they really tested it that it's not just a mood, or it's not just that there was a real desire. In fact, one of the books in the Bible is the book about the scroll of Ruth. And Ruth is a convert, and she becomes the ancestor of King David, who traditionally is the person who wrote all the Psalms. And then the Christians, their mythology is through that they connect Jesus to King David. So actually, a very important, also from a mystical point of view, they say that Ruth was the person who brought love to Israel. So, in Israel, by the way, is not a political name at that time. Israel is the name of the people, the Israelites, the Jewish people. So there's always been a possibility for conversion. It's never been easy. People really want to know, do you really want to do it? And part of it is also be realistic. The Orthodox traditional Jewish path is a laborious, demanding path. And you have to know a lot and learn, for some time to really know, is this really something I want to get into? So that's why they didn't just go, and the whole thing was not about numbers. In fact, the only time that Judaism was did something that other religions often did, which is convert by force, there was one short historical time. It was during the time of the Hasmoneites. And without going into detail, it's had some disastrous consequences. I'm very glad we did not, as a people, participate in that.
And I was thinking about our conversation this morning here. Something that comes up when you think about Judaism and, of course, Jewish mysticism, that in the context of the Jewish culture, it was at least one of the first time that this whole relationship to the divine as being the unnameable, that one that you cannot make an image of, came about,
Right.
which maybe be part of the historic contribution of the Israel culture to world culture in that sense, that at least in the Western hemispheres, it had a rooting factor in the transformation to the previous forms of polytheism, to a relationship to the divine that is one, undivided, and unnameable. And when I was thinking about this, I came to another thought that I never thought about, that there is obviously the ban of not making any images. I mean, the whole controversy between Moses and in the Israelites about the golden calf is stands for that, and others. But isn't it that at the same time, Israelites had this different relationship that is the importance of the sacred text in a way that seems to be different than old Sumerian or Babylonian texts, which were mere temple rites or something like that. So there's a shift, basically the ban of all images and the unnameable God being unnameable, in the same time, God in writing, speaking in writing. Is that kind of a hint where some roots of spiritual mysticism are about?
So, yes, Jewish mysticism is definitely connected to revelation. And that is at least in the Western Hemisphere unique, but actually not as unique as I was led to believe, because I realized that a very similar tradition of revelation exists in the Vedic culture. So there is kind of a culture, and even somebody once showed me things about Plato that is there. In other words, there is a sense in those traditions, both the Vedic and the Jewish culture, and I cannot say, you can probably say more about the Greek philosophy, that there is a level in which the intelligence of the universe is reverberating within itself. And there is a way in which one can take one's awareness to hear that murmur. And that murmur is beyond words, but you express it through your nervous system, and then it becomes the prophecy of such and such, or the cognition of this particular seer in the Vedic tradition. Or later on, the way the Quran was revealed to Muhammad. There are the traditions that there is a level in which there is the intelligence of the universe speaks to itself constantly. And there are beautiful stories about that. Meister Eckhart talked about it in the Jewish tradition and Muslim tradition. We could spend hours just about those stories. That's one thing. The other thing is, again, my background is as a kind of a practicing Hindu and a practicing Jew, is that I don't look at Hinduism in its root as non-monotheistic. Of course, they have the different expressions of the divine. But underneath, if you look at the scripture and the texts, is this unmanifest reality of these are just manifestation of different aspects of the divine. These are the different deities. So that's the second thing. And the third point, for example, about the forbidding images in Judaism. So Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, one of the foremost mystical thinkers in America in the 20th century, once talked about the fact that the reason God doesn't allow you to make images of himself is because each one of us is an image of God. So we are walking images of God, and therefore it is not allowed to make other images that really don't portray him. And in the Jewish tradition, there's they say there's a passage about the difference between the images of God that Roman emperors used to do of themselves, that they coined, they put their faces on the coins, and each face was the same. They said, look at this, earthly kings, the face is always the same when they put images of themselves. But the King of Kings, when he does images of himself, each one is different. Each person is an image of the divine.
There's another aspect of Jewish mysticism that at least strikes me, that I don't find in many others. And interesting enough, this particular, not at all in Indian mysticism, and that's the connection of revelation and the history of a people.
Right.
So that the whole divine revelation lays out in a narrative that becomes history, a history of being falling and basically rising up to the divine, but unfolding in time. And in that sense, another contribution, at least Western culture, but you could say to culture, is the invention of history. Of course, it started ethnocentric with the Jewish history, but this relationship between us, first, that this us is a collective us. And second, that this collective us is a historic us. It's developing through historic lines. You have all these stories from starting from Abraham and the promise that there will be countless peoples, and Egypt story, Babylon story. It's a development of tragedies and resurrections and all kind of that. That seems to be something that we all learned from this culture as a certain relationship to history, because the Greek philosopher didn't have this kind of relationship to history. The Greek mystics didn't have this to their gods, this relationship to history. There's a certain kind in relationship to the God that's not just individual, and that's, if it's collective, also not static collective, but in a whole unfolding. I find this very powerful.
So I agree with you that at least in the West, that's the case. I would say that actually, I would argue that in India, there's a little bit of a taste of that. For example, the Mahabharata, which is the story of the war of the, it's understood by them as a historical thing, even though it's full of all those mythical elements. And there is even, there's a place where they define as Kurukshetra, which is the field where the Mahabharata war happened. And they talk about all the rishis like Vashishta and Vyasa, which appear in the traditions and in those mythologies, as they assume that they have actually lived. So there is a little bit more of that. But you're right. The mythology, so to speak, some people say Jews don't have a mythology, because for them it's not a mythology, it's history. But I look at it differently. I see, you look at the history and you present, at least in the Bible is, you present the events in history not because you care to tell the details of what, quote unquote, actually happened, but you tell the story because you want to create a certain effect in consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that the main effect that they want to create is invoke a collective mystical experience. Because, for example, the story of the revelation of the Torah in front of Mount Sinai was not a story of one person. It was a story of supposedly hundreds of thousands or millions of people standing in front of Mount Sinai and having a collective experience of revelation. And you and I have had some spiritual experiences in our history that showed us that something like that is possible. In fact, I would say that part of my path, the part of the path that we did together, and my experience of that collective dimension of a mystical experience, that made me for the first time think that, wow, maybe those stories from the past, which I also always treated as fairy tales, are real. And this collective experience, direct experience of the divine, is actually possible as a large group. So I would say you're right that it's history, but it's not really history. It's history told in order to create a mystical effect.
No, I see that. At the same time, my impression is the mystical effect is a different one. Because let's say the mythology of Buddha first, it's very individual. But let's put that aside. It's a letting go of the world in that. The way I read the Bible as I read it from my Christian background, the revelation is not that in the moment of whatever this revelation about, it's about letting go of the world, but being there for the future of the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a different relationship that is the spiritual revelation is about. Mm-hmm. Unless we are living at the end of times, which also you can say that very often was the assumption that we live there in the end of times, and that then it's about the collective ending. But until it's not about the collective ending, it always the inside has something that this particular Buddhist, but also most Vedantic revelations don't have. It is something that is unfolding in time and is asked from us to be there for future. And that it's a different mystical experience. Would you agree?
I understand what you're saying. Yes, it's not. It's definitely not treating the world as an illusion, which those other traditions that you mentioned do at times. Certain branches of them. Now, I would like to say, as I've told you just in the few minutes that we talked before we started recording, there are different strands of Jewish mysticism, mm-hmm. and just as the society evolves, also Judaism has evolved. And the kind of mysticism, for example, that evolved as a result of the Zohar, people know the quite well known even in Christian circles, the Book of Zohar. It's again, depending on who you ask, whether it was written in the second century, first or second century AD, or whether it was written on the 13th century AD, which is what the most researchers believe. But it was a certain mysticism where the job of the individual and the community practicing was to create balance in the divine spheres. Mm-hmm. So through my performance of all the rituals, I'm actually ensuring that there's balance in heavens. It is my job on earth. Now, that mysticism has evolved in the 18th century and has become Hasidism, which is what I'm interested in, which in some way is the beginning, is a mysticism for the modern age, in the sense, at least how it started, not how it has evolved, but how it started was a mysticism which is very individual. Mm-hmm. A very individual mysticism where you can experience your divine essence. The temple is in you. Everything is about you, Thomas, what you do right now. And it's not, you don't do the performances and the rituals in order to affect heavens. You do it in order to create a deeper connection between you and God.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the mysticism which I'm interested in, which in some way has even elements that remind me of Vedanta and Tantra sometimes even. But it basically is that particular mysticism is a mysticism, the way I look at it. Those early Hasids, like the Baal Shem Tov and the Maggid of Meserich, they basically had deep spiritual experiences, and they used the words of the Bible completely out of context at times, mm-hmm. just to convey that experience to others. Mm-hmm. And they were masters at it. And their knowledge of the Jewish body of knowledge, like the Talmud, the Mishnah, the Bible, they were geniuses. They were just like, if you ever see Oscar Peterson sit at the piano and how he's one with the piano, they were just like one with the corpus of Jewish texts, and they just use everything with incredible dexterity mm-hmm. to express their mystical insights. And I would like to mention something that was surprising to me recently when I found out that Jung referred to them, to the Hasids, to the early Hasids, as the people who, let me read to you a quote from Jung, which will be interesting. In an interview, which he did, or it was published in 1977, he goes, "But do you know who anticipated my entire psychology in the 18th century? The Hasidic Rabbi Baer from Meserich, whom they called the Great Maggid. He was a most impressive man."
Mm.
So there was this incredible depth these people had, and they sought to convey that depth to their own people in the language that they knew.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always through the revelation, always through the Torah, always through the Talmud.
Powerful. And also what you pointed out by pointing out Hasidism as a special form of Judaism that developed several hundred years ago, but hasn't been there from the beginning. That also, again, puts Judaism in the course of history, in that sense, in the course of cultural history, because what you described as this different relationship to the divine is very much an individuated relationship to the divine that also relates to the individuation process, at least of the European culture. In that time, so this mystical experience falls on a not say a higher but different individuated person that then allows to interpret the relationship to the absolute, to God, from this individuated standpoint. And in that sense, it has a lot of similarities also with the development of Christianity. And there's something that's related to that. And I also would like to ask you that specific as a trauma therapist. Because it seems there's something very unique in also in this, especially in Hasidic mysticism, that is, and I would interpret it comes from the history of the Jewish people, that it's related to the brokenness of history and the brokenness of the world.
Yeah.
There's something, even if I recall right, this whole idea that basically that the sacred is broken and basically and needs to be picked up again, right? That these are something that seem to come directly out of traumatic experience of the Jewish people. And in that sense, in this individuated sense of the sacred, but also in the traumatic experience of that, individually and collectively, there's a certain mysticism that's related to this.
Yeah. No, that's very true. The thing is, if already in biblical literature, if you read the Psalms, which Christians also read, the Psalms is their hymns that scan the entire range of human experience. In fact, I remember as a high school boy, we had to learn, even though I went to a secular school, you have to learn the Bible is a fundamental Hebrew literature. And I remember it when in 12th grade, we learned the Psalms, and I go, wow, here's 150 hymns. And for the author of the Psalms, God is an object of love that is more real than my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually even said that. I said, I will never have that experience because I don't believe in God. That's just the short while before I started meditating and everything changed for me. But this was such, and everything is there. There's, you have to deal with the human experience in the context of God.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been the characteristics of human life since then, of Jewish life. How do you deal with this promise of perfection from God? With all those psalms that promise you that you will be protected and you will be safe if you only hang on to God. How do you deal with that, with the fact that we've suffered so much? And then you need to actually bring all kinds of philosophical acrobatics to justify that. We haven't performed it well enough. At first, it was like that. At first, if you look at how it developed over the years, that philosophical qualm of how a righteous person suffers and an evil person thrives has been a philosophical dilemma that we have had to deal with. And then we found ways of dealing with it, which evolved as consciousness of the world evolves. And first it was, oh, we haven't performed the things well enough. We haven't, it's because of our sins. And then later on, it's because of fundamental breakage in the divinity that occurred in the very beginning. And we, through our performances, restore the balance in the universe. And that's the Kabbalah in the Middle Ages. And then in terms of cycle, that's the time, but time will change and like that. All those different ways of justifying that particular kind of, we've always had to deal with it because somehow, one way or the other, trauma and suffering has always been part of our life. And as a trauma therapist, I'm also interested in various ways of dealing with trauma within some parts of Jewish Hasidism, which actually show a lot of insights, which in terms of human understanding, which I'm using now. and also to realize we don't know anything. And sometimes it was, we were trying to do, as Jews, spiritual bypass, because we didn't know enough about psychology to deal with trauma. But you're right, trauma has been part of our upbringing, maybe, and our, part of our mythology also from the very beginning.
Egal, of course, we have not even scratched the surface. Oh, maybe we have, yeah. But a tiny bit. But we run out of time. And maybe we leave it with this question, because it seems a very poignant question. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Yes, thank you very much. I enjoy talking to you as always.